Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we start this hour in Ventura, California, between Los Angeles and Santa Barbara, where a huge wildfire is spreading fast with the help of the Santa Ana winds. The cities of Santa Paula and Ventura are under mandatory evacuation, and the fire is said to be out of control. Ventura County Fire Chief Mark Lorenzen spoke last night.
We are making sure we are out ahead of the fire, making sure we have evacuations in advance of the fire, and we're basically leapfrogging our engines, doing structure defense as the fire proceeds.
Alex Cohen is following the story for KPCC and joins us now from Pasadena. And Alex, what is the latest? What do we know about the extent of the fire?
Well, what we know about the extent of this fire, and currently now there are two burning here in Southern California, that this fire, which is called the Thomas Fire because it broke out near Thomas Aquinas College in Santa Paula, it broke out last night. It started off on this kind of winding mountain road. It's actually a very beautiful highway that goes to the town of Ojai, and it spread very rapidly. And that's thanks to those Santa Ana winds that you mentioned. There were red flag warnings issued about this, these winds. Those warnings came out Sunday. We knew that this was coming, but I've never in more than 15 years of covering fires in Southern California seen winds traveling this quickly, spreading the flames so very rapidly.
And how densely populated is the area that we're talking about? It's kind of outside of the greater LA area, but still sort of part of the region.
It's a real mixture of areas out there. We had the 400 students at Thomas Aquinas College who were evacuated. There is one behavioral health hospital. It's being described as the Del Mar Hospital that caught fire very quickly. So you had people in this area. And one reporter I spoke with this morning described fingers of flames that came down from the mountains into residential neighborhoods. So you've got this mix of residential and more rural, commercial. Ventura City Hall, I believe, was either damaged or destroyed during the course of this fire. And evacuations, we should note, both for humans and animals, some of them rather large. This is horse country, too.
Now, obviously, wildfires are a regular part of life in California. There were the devastating fires in October in wine country. More than 40 people died. You've covered a number of fires. How does this one compare?
Again, Jeremy, I'll say the big difference here is the weather, which is really scary. We often see fire season, as they used to call it. It's now pretty much year-round during those warmer months. It's December, but that doesn't stop the heat here in Southern California. I was just looking at the forecast for Santa Paula. It's kind of in the high 60s, low 70s now, but they're looking at 80-degree temperatures. They're also saying this is not the worst of the winds. They're expected to die down somewhat later on this afternoon, and then pick up again. The National Weather Service is saying the worst of it will likely come Wednesday and into Thursday. So right now, what we're really looking at is a race against time. Can firefighters get in control of this fire before the winds pick up even more and before it becomes even warmer, which really poses a challenge to the men and women who are on the front lines?
Has the devastation from those wildfires we mentioned in Northern California had any impact on how residents and officials are handling this fire? I saw one woman in a car this morning saying after those fires, she was not going to wait. She was just going to get out.
You raise a very interesting point. In the past, I've talked to many people who would say to me, look, I know they're saying to evacuate, but this is my home. This is my property. I want to stay here and defend it. More than 40 lives were lost during those wildfires that happened in Northern California. And from what I've been hearing and seeing this morning, residents are taking the warnings very seriously. Of course, they were issued in the middle of the night. In many instances, they continue this morning. I should admit, you know, tens of thousands of people evacuated, not only in Ventura County, where this Thomas Fire is burning, but also a lot of evacuations happening right now in the second fire, which is broken out in an area known as Sylmar, about 50 miles east of the first fire.
That's Alex Cohen at KPCC in Pasadena, California, talking with us about the wildfires burning there. We'll keep an eye on it. Alex, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, as we head into the end of the year, we'll be checking in with different parts of the country that had a catastrophic 2017, from shootings to hurricanes to wildfires. And today we want to head to Northern California, as we just heard, tremendous loss of life in those wildfires. But thousands of homes and businesses were also destroyed in the October fires, adding to an already bulging homeless population. In Santa Rosa, officials cleared out an encampment under an underpass in November, thinking people would move to shelters. But they were full. Soon, over 75 tents sprang up behind the dollar store. City leaders are considering allowing more sanctioned parking spots where the homeless can sleep overnight. Jenny Lynn Holmes is well known in Santa Rosa as Senior Director of Shelter and Housing for Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Santa Rosa. They are the largest nonprofit homeless services provider. Jenny Lynn, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we know you were raised in Santa Rosa, one of the hardest hit cities. They only had a 1% vacancy rate before the fires, and then 5% of the housing stock disappeared, burned, 3,000 homes gone. And by the way, having been raised there, do you know people who lost homes?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's a person you'll find in Santa Rosa or Sonoma County that doesn't know multiple people who've lost their homes.
Yeah.
It really touched so many different people of economic levels as well as just social status. And it's hard to look at the comprehensive amount of work we need to do to meet everybody's unique needs.
Well, we would presume that people maybe even in the higher income brackets who had home insurance are probably thinking of rebuilding. But what has happened to the people who were renting?
Yeah, so the renting population is the population that we're really focused in on. But additionally, we're really prepping and have already started seeing what we're kind of calling a second wave of victims. People who are being pushed out of housing, you know, their unit didn't burn, but because of the fire and this new market, it is completely taking them offline.
Well, let's explain. Zillow data indicates that between September and mid-October, so mid-October is way past the fires of the 8th, asking rents jumped 36% in Sonoma, 23% in Napa. I thought there was a California law that makes it illegal to raise rents by more than 10% after a disaster.
There is price gouging laws in place, but one of the things we're seeing is landlords who maybe lost their home in the fire have a second unit they were renting, and they're now, those people who are in that rental are being evicted so that they have a home to live while they rebuild.
So you talk about this second wave of people evicted. Are these people, given that rents are so high, are any of them becoming part of the homeless population?
Oh, absolutely. And we're kind of seeing the trend of what happened with the 2008 foreclosure crisis. We saw people entering homelessness for the first time ever after that, and we're predicting that to happen in the next few months here. And unfortunately, it seems like it's happening a little faster than it did with the 2008 foreclosure crisis.
Well, and your area, like just about every part of California, we've reported on how the housing crisis and the lack of housing has just created this huge homeless community, including college students, people living in RVs, people living in tents. What's the thinking about the chronically homeless?
Yeah, so that's the important part of the conversation is, you know, we had these high priority issues for our community prior to the fire on October 7th. Then the fires hit October 8th and everything is magnified. Mm. And what's really important is as we're rebuilding as a community that we look at things holistically. We don't just address the people who were displaced directly by the fire in our rebuilding efforts.
Yeah, you know, one day, what a difference a day makes, because there had been this whole housing first move to get people out of these tent encampments. Jenny Lynn, what do you say to people who say, look, we understand people who were burned out by a fire or kicked out of an apartment because their landlord was burned out by a fire? You know, we need to help them. But people who are chronically homeless, they are just expecting that people like you, good-hearted people like you, will come up with ways to pitch tents on parking spots, and it doesn't help them. It just, the problem just becomes larger and larger. What would you say to them?
You know, as a community, we need to do better than having people sleeping in tents and in bushes and things like that. And we need to not be okay with that as a solution for our community. We need to keep pushing for housing and capacity to end their homelessness on a long-term basis.
By the way, the median monthly rent is around $2,500, double the national average. The median home price, more than $600,000.
Yeah, and that's where we have to get creative as a community. And, you know, we've been looking at a lot of ways to do shared housing, and how do we pair people up that maybe couldn't afford housing separate, but together they can? Or how do we look at converting units? You know, we just converted a 104-unit motel into permanent supportive housing for chronically homeless and the homeless veterans. And those are the types of things that housing that can come online more quickly and, you know, get around the red tape to make housing possible for every person who needs it.
That's Jenny Lynn Holmes, Director of Shelter and Housing for Catholic Charities in Santa Rosa, California. By the way, we'll link you up. It is the holiday season, in case you want to help out. Jenny Lynn, thank you so much.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for, you know, talking about this very, very important issue. And, you know, our community is feeling a lot of emotions and trauma right now, but we're also feeling a lot of love and support from across the nation. So we're grateful for that.
Okay. Take care.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
There's news today about the Catalan independence movement. Remember in October, Catalans voted for independence from Spain in a dispute that goes back to the Franco dictatorship, which ended when he died in 1975. Spain's new constitution then set up autonomous regions and a central government that collected taxes and distributed funds. And many Catalans felt they were subsidizing poorer parts of the country. Well, Spain ruled their independence vote illegal, dissolved the Catalan government, arrested some of the leaders, and called a new election December 21st. Now, Catalonia's ex-president Carles Puigdemont fled to Belgium. But today, a Spanish judge withdrew arrest warrants for him and four other ministers. The BBC's Gavin Lee joins us from downtown Barcelona. And Gavin, what does this judge's decision mean for Puigdemont?
Well, bear in mind that for over a month now, he's been living continuously in Brussels, self-imposed exile with another four ex-ministers who's pretty much the 3 days after the whole separatist government here in Barcelona, and what they wanted to declare the capital of their new country, they declared this the new Republic of Catalonia, they declared independence, they voted for it. Nothing happened apart from he left for Belgium. The other ministers were rounded up and brought to court. Most of them spent the last month in prison in case they would flee. Remanded in custody like Carles Puigdemont, and some of them came out of prison yesterday. Now, for Carles Puigdemont, he's been told today by a Spanish judge that they are withdrawing the warrant for his arrest for two reasons. One is because what's happening right now is the way the European system works is the Belgian judge looks at the three charges he could face, which is sedition and rebellion, effectively acting against the state. Rebellion is actually one of the worst crimes in Spain to commit, up to 30 years in prison. It includes encouraging violence as well, and also embezzlement. So the Spanish judge is saying that he didn't want this diluted. He wanted to make sure they controlled that, and not a Belgian judge deciding that perhaps one of them didn't fit into the system. The other thing that's going on, Robin, is the judge has said he believes that he has it on good authority that Carles Puigdemont will return on his own accord to Catalonia to take part in the elections in 3 weeks. The launch is today, so I think combine those two things, I think that's the reason that the judge believes they've got grounds to think he's coming back.
Well, but coming back as a completely free man?
No, that's the other thing. I think there's the rub to this. Those potential charges are all still there. He is more than likely, I think he is expected to be arrested as soon as he does arrive back in Catalonia. He will go to court. The decision will be made, do you release him on bail, or is he considered a continued threat to flee? So I think from talking to lawyers here, the likelihood is that he would come back to start the campaign. He would go to court, his passport would be taken off him, and then he would continue to campaign like the other ministers. So I think there are numerous things up in the air at the moment. I've spoken to Carles Puigdemont's lawyers in Belgium. He's very hard for him to get hold of, by the way. I've tried for a month. He's very selective which media he speaks to. He spoke briefly to me at the BBC. But today they're saying that he's not planning to travel in the next few days, but they are delighted with the result. They believe that the states, the accused of a coup d'etat, are realising that they've got too much support behind them. So there's a lot of politicking going on right now, Robin, as well. As I say, day one of the election campaign. And the only other thing I think is worth bearing in mind here, the only other name to mention It's worth knowing the main candidate many people tip if the Independence Party's win is a man called Oriol Junqueras. He was the deputy president. He is one of two ministers still in prison right now. So that really fragments all the Independence parties ahead of this election.
Well, yes, if the main candidate's in prison. So not everybody was released from prison, as you said yesterday when these warrants were lifted. But Carlos Puigdemont has said he would return if he was guaranteed a fair trial. He said that in the past. Is it expected that he might get one?
Carlos Puigdemont's team are still saying that they will not get a fair trial. They point to the fact that Spain is something like 48th in a world index of independent judiciaries, and Belgium is number 20. And they say actually there are lots of issues with political problems with the judiciary. Now, I've spoken to many lawyers and many judges here in Spain, and actually the point that they continue to raise is not that it's linked. They always say politics is separate to the judiciary. It's very slow. And so you have a case here where you've had other ministers in prison for more than a month. You have some people who can spend up to 2 years in prison without facing any charges, simply waiting for their case to come up and then perhaps being freed and cleared. So I think that is also a concern for Carlos Puigdemont. But, you know, he can expect, I think, an unpredictable time if he comes back here. It's whether or not he decides to make that gamble.
The BBC's Gavin Lee speaking with us from Barcelona, very busy Barcelona. Gavin, thank you so much.
All the best. Thanks, Robin.
What would happen to you if you questioned your faith? Well, for people in the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS, questioning the faith can cost you salvation in the next life and your entire support network in this life. That's the reality for many in small rural community known as Short Creek, which includes the towns of Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah. That's the home of the FLDS Church, a polygamous group whose leader, Warren Jeffs, is currently serving a life sentence for 2 counts of child sexual assault. Sarah Ventry from KJZZ reports on what it's like for a few of those who have left the church and been deemed apostates.
5 years ago, when George and Miriam Jessup left the church, FLDS prophet Warren Jeffs had imposed strict mandates on followers, and the Jessups adhered to many of them. They homeschooled their kids, they didn't associate with non-church members, and they were told that leaving meant they were going to hell.
We were choosing to go to hell and be happier there than we would be unhappy going to heaven.
This decision also meant rethinking the entire concept of God.
After we got out and we realized what was going on then.
We didn't like the God that the FLDS gave us, so we traded it in for a new one.
Others didn't leave the church by choice. Some were sent away, like Lawrence Barlow. He was told to leave the community around the same time the Jessups left, when the rules had become all-encompassing. No internet, no non-religious music, a strict dress code. Some married couples were even barred from having sexual relations. And going one giant step further, there was an exclusive group called the United Order, created within the church for those who were most righteous. Barlow says everyone in his family was given membership, except him.
So I got a phone call from the bishop's office, and he came on and read a revelation that I was guilty of everything unforgivable, from murder and adultery to denying the Christ. And I said, I don't know how it can be true, but I imagine if the Lord says it's true, I better go figure out how it could be. And he just said, by the voice of your own confession, you're guilty of these things.
After that, he was expected to leave as soon as possible. His family was told they couldn't contact him, and in an instant, he was on his own. He was away for about a year and a half before he moved back to Short Creek. His wife had a stroke, and he wanted to be here to take care of her. They have a good relationship now, but it took time to heal, not just with her, but with many people.
Experience of leaving the church is that's something that just kind of happens to you. It's like sliding down the slide. It's that bump at the end that gets you. Then you get the painful process of climbing the hill again.
My name is Elisa Wall, and I was born and raised till about the age of 18 in the religious cult called the FLDS.
Wall may be the most well-known ex-FLDS member. That's because she brought a lawsuit against Warren Jeffs. She says he forced her to marry her first cousin in an arranged marriage when she was just 14 years old.
And the way that that happened was very much against my will, and it was a very painful and difficult time of my life. The years that followed were incredibly abusive, physically, mentally, and sexually.
For those who are still devout, Wall could easily be seen as the worst kind of apostate. Not only did she leave the church, but she worked to bring down its powerful leader. And her lawsuit was successful. But it hasn't been easy. Wall's mother and many other family members are still in the church, and she hasn't spoken to them in over a decade.
It's just a very difficult realization of realizing that they don't have the option to love me because it threatens their very existence as they know it. And I hope that changes someday. I hope that I can look my mother in her eyes before she passes away and thank her for the good things that she did give me and heal the things that we have yet to heal.
And even after everything that happened, Wall, like Barlow, came back to Short Creek.
I had to face the demons that I thought resided here, that had tortured me for so many years of my life. And it was kind of a stubborn determination that I was more than those shadows. I was more than those demons.
George and Miriam Jessup never actually left the community. They wanted to, but as the parents of 12 children, they couldn't afford it. They did put their kids back in public school, something the church had told them not to do. And even though they were in Short Creek, they lost most of their social network for about a year.
All of a sudden, nobody came over. There were no friends. The people that were visiting you last Sunday, you never saw them again.
Over time, they built up a circle of friends, including others who also left the church. For the Jessups, rebuilding community has been deeply important. They even started a nonprofit to put on a 4th of July event. And in a place where patriotic celebrations were banned, that's a radical act. So while it's part of remaking themselves, it's also part of remaking the community. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Ventry.
There are reports that President Trump is ready to announce his decision on the status of Jerusalem. The official Palestinian press reports that President Trump told Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas today that he intends to relocate the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Abbas reportedly warned President Trump of dangerous consequences if that happens. He has said that there could never be a Palestinian state without East Jerusalem as its capital. Joining us now is Greg Myrie, NPR national security correspondent. And Greg, we've been expecting an announcement from President Trump on this. Do we know when it's coming?
No, we still don't. We're expecting it any time. Could come today, tomorrow. He's facing a deadline to do something, and we're expecting it at any point, but we still haven't heard any official word from the White House.
And is it likely that the president will actually build a new embassy in Jerusalem or simply recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel but keep the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv?
Don't want to jump the gun, but it could be either of those possibilities. The U.S. does have a consulate in Jerusalem, and that deals with Jerusalem residents. It deals with Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That could potentially become an embassy. The current embassy is in Tel Aviv, but there already is this diplomatic building in Jerusalem, which would be the likely home of a new embassy if indeed that's the way that the president decides to go.
We spoke last week with Aaron David Miller, who's a former advisor to secretaries of state in both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's now at the Wilson Center, and he told us that this would be the single dumbest move the administration has made in the Middle East. Here he is.
In large part because there's not a single compelling American national interest, in my judgment, that would impel, compel, or justify that action.
The president is also facing a lot of criticism about this from the Arab world. Tell us about some of the reaction in the region.
Sure. Already getting a very strong reaction. The Palestinians, first and foremost, there will certainly be protest. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, apparently has tried to talk Trump out of this. But also neighboring countries, Turkey, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia. And important to note, Israel does have diplomatic relations with three countries in particular, Egypt, Jordan, and Turkey. So those relationships could be put in jeopardy. And it will make make U.S. relations throughout the region more difficult with all these countries. This really is a very important issue. Difficult to overstate how strongly Arab countries feel and Arab individuals feel about Jerusalem. It just grabs everybody's emotion.
Yeah, Turkey's president said today that this would be a red line for Muslims.
He's absolutely true. And that really does span the Muslim world. And again, we're hearing this from U.S. allies, leaders in countries like Turkey and Egypt and Saudi Arabia. It will certainly also be a rallying cry for militants and extremists. Not that they need another reason to attack the U.S. They certainly always seem to have one. But this is the kind of thing that radical groups would use as a rallying cry. So both from allies and from rivals in the Middle East, the U.S. will get a lot of criticism and potential blowback.
All right. Well, we'll be watching to see what the president does decide, and we'll bring that news to you when we get it. Greg Myrie, NPR National Security Correspondent, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Native American nations and environmental groups have launched legal battles in response to President Trump's reduction of two vast Utah monuments, Grand Staircase Escalante and Bear's Ears. Yesterday, a Navajo Nation delegate told us he was against the reduction because it means less protection for antiquities and keeping sacred land safe from drilling and mining. Well, today, rancher Leland Pollock, commissioner of Garfield County, which is home to Grand Staircase. Leland, you applaud the president's reduction. Why?
Well, first of all, I would like to thank our president. Second thing I'd like to point out is Utahns, we are not against monuments. Bryce Canyon is a classic example of what can become from that use of the Antiquities Act. Now, Bryce Canyon is 35,000 acres. The Grand Staircase, when it was all said and done, was 2 million acres.
Well, and you join the voices saying these were just too massive. And yeah, we should say that in Utah, two-thirds of Utah is public land. So many park and now monument spaces, only 33% of land is left, many people say, to fund everything, to be taxed and fund everything. But the Bear's Ears designation, for instance, was based on a Republican Utah congressman's outline of a protected area. This is Rob Bishop's plan that he took to Congress for 3 years, fought to try to get that land protected, never got through Congress. And so the Obama administration used Rob Bishop's outline to designate the Bear's Ears Monument. Some would say that that means it's just political, that it was, you know, you didn't like it when a Democratic president did it, but it'd be okay if Utah Republican lawmakers did it.
No, that was the Public Lands Initiative. I was the Public Lands Chairman for 2 years. So I'm well aware of that process and all that. That's absolutely not true. But as far as the Grand Staircase is concerned, you still have a huge monument.
Right. Why is it that you'd like to see it reduced? I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're a rancher. Grazing is permitted on both the monuments. So what is it that you want to see that couldn't happen? Why were you objecting to the massive protection?
I'm also a sportsman, and I'm also a conservationist, and I'm also into habitat recovery projects. When it becomes a monument, that is restricted land. We were not allowed to do recovery projects.
What do you mean by recovery?
Recovery means for over 100 years, the ranching community kept all of the water sources going,
right,
was involved in projects to get rid of invasive weeds, soil erosion. And if you do not have a management plan, you're going to have to do recovery projects. And none of that was done over the 21-year period that it was a monument. There was too many restrictions.
And we should say there was huge criticism with Escalante, that it took, I think, 4 years to even come up with a management plan, that Bear's Ears is massive but didn't have the allotted staff that could even patrol it. We hear your criticism there, but you know the biggest concern is that some of this land is going to be now sold off, oil and gas drilling, mining, motorized vehicle use. And the thing, the very thing that brings people to Utah in the first place, this gorgeous state, will be destroyed.
That's nonsense. These lands are going to become better. They're not going to be overused. It's too massive. It's too expansive. A lot of that area, you'll not see any tourism. You'll not see anything that is beautiful like Bryce Canyon. You will see land that has been tied up. That's why I say we're not against monuments. What we're against is the wrongful use of the Antiquities Act just to tie up and control land.
Do you worry about the message that this might send out, though, to, let's say, retailers? Because it reads like, Utahns who are against the expanded monuments are for drilling, are for mining. That's how it reads. And as you know, huge outlets like Patagonia dropped out of the big OR, the big outdoor retailer show that's held every year in Salt Lake City. Are you worried about backlash against the state?
I'm sorry. That is so wrong. The Bryce Canyon, for example, just had a record year. Our tourism, our TRT revenue, it's a tax that you yeah. get from tourism, is at a record rate. No, I'm not worried about that. You're going to see an uptick because those lands are going to be advertised correctly. We can now promote them. Garfield County could not promote. Our tourism could not, council could not promote certain areas on that, the old prior monument. We're excited about this. The tourism industry, by and large, around Bryce Canyon, knows what can be done. They get 2 million visitors in that little park every year. The Grand Staircase, most of it was not visited. I'm sorry, that's just the facts. And one of the reasons is, how do you visit and come from back east or wherever without a paved road or without a maintained road? Most people come in a rental vehicle. And so they were not allowed through the rental contracts, or nobody would do it in their right mind, take their touring car and try to see this area. Now we can change that. So I'm excited about what we can do for the tourism industry.
That's Leland Pollack, Commissioner of Utah's Garfield County. They surround the Grand Staircase Escalante monument, which has been reduced. Commissioner, thank you so much for speaking with us.
All right. Thank you for your time.
Let's go now to Washington, D.C., in a form of silent protest that may soon appear in front of the Russian embassy. It's located on Wisconsin Avenue, but a bill before the D.C. City Council would rename the portion of the avenue that's in front of the Russian embassy after Boris Nemtsov, a prominent vocal critic of President Putin, who was assassinated in 2015. Martin Astermule from member station WAMU reports.
Washington, D.C. City Council member Mary Chase says she introduced the bill renaming that block of Wisconsin Avenue after Nemtsov to send a message of support to the Russian people.
People are being assassinated simply because they're agitating for democracy. And that's wrong. And if this is a small way of us saying that that's wrong, I'm happy to do it.
Symbolically renaming streets in the nation's capital to commemorate important people is nothing new. Musician Marvin Gaye and poet Langston Hughes each have blocks named after them. So do gay rights pioneer Frank Kameny and civil rights activist Malcolm X. There's even a neighborhood street known as Queen's Stroll Place, so named because in 1991 Queen Elizabeth took a walk there while visiting town. But Che's proposal for Boris Nemtsov Plaza is of a different breed. It directly criticizes Russia and does so right in front of its embassy. The idea originally came from Florida Senator Marco Rubio, but he passed it off to Councilwoman Che when the Senate seemed unlikely to move forward with it.
I learned that it may be stalled in the Congress, and so we were sort of plan B, I guess.
This isn't the first time international politics has made its way onto D.C. street signs. In the late 1980s, a portion of 16th Street in front of what was then the Russian embassy was renamed after dissident Andrei Sakharov. The signs for Sakharov Plaza remain there today. But such symbolic attacks can come at a cost. Last year, an effort in the Senate to rename a street in front of the Chinese embassy after a dissident was met with a veto threat from then-President Obama. He said he worried it would complicate relations between the two countries. And that's exactly what Washingtonian Helen Andrews says she fears will happen between the U.S. and Russia if Boris Nemtsov Plaza becomes a reality.
Relations with Russia right now are already bad enough. We don't need to be sticking a finger in their eye.
Andrews, who's a writer, also says that these symbolic renamings are usually lost on residents and visitors. As an example, she points to Sakharov Plaza.
I walked down this street all the time and didn't know that it was Sakharov Plaza, so I don't think the residents will notice Boris Nemtsov Plaza, you know, one way or the other. So its only effect will be to annoy Russia for no good reason.
But for Maryland resident James Adai, annoying Russia is a good reason to rename Wisconsin Avenue in front of the embassy.
Russians meddled in our election, so every little thing we can do to hit back, I'm for it.
Neither the Russian embassy nor the State Department responded to requests for comment. But if they want to weigh in, the city council is holding a hearing on the proposed renaming tomorrow. And according to council staff, Nemtsov's daughter Zhanna is expected to speak in favor of the bill. For her part, Councilwoman Che says she has not been dissuaded by any possible international repercussions to the renaming.
For me, it's the right thing to do, and I'm very pleased to do it, so I'm going to go forward.
If the bill makes its way through the city council, Congress will still have a chance to weigh in and block the bill if it chooses. For Here and Now, I'm Martin Ostermule in Washington.
Facebook is opening its doors to kids aged 13 and under. Yesterday, the company released a new app called Messenger Kids, one of just a handful of social apps built specifically for younger children. It's reignited debate over how much technology is too much for kids and how safe it can be. Let's get to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media for Recode and joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with this app. What does it do and what makes it different than others?
Yeah, so this is a messaging app specifically. And so a parent of a kid under the age of 13, 13 is the age limit for using Facebook, where you could use Messenger, which is their standalone messaging app. So if you're a parent of a kid under the age of 13, you could create an account for them on Messenger Kids. And basically, it's a standalone app that works similar to text messaging. And the parents have all the control over who the kids can talk to, and the kids can't delete any messages. So if a parent wanted to ever, you know, go take the phone or take the iPad or whatever it may be and go through and see what the kids are actually talking about, they would be able to do that too. So the point of this is to give the parents as much control as possible over who and how their kids are talking.
I imagine the point of it, though, is also to get more people on Facebook.
I think that that's a nice side effect, if you will, of rolling out an app like this, right? I mean, if you're Facebook and you're trying to, you know, continually get the next generation of internet users to use your products, introducing an app for kids who are, you know, in elementary school is a pretty good way to ensure that if they're using your product that early on, they're probably going to graduate at some point from this Messenger Kids app to the main Facebook app.
And there are some studies that have shown that kids and teens have been leaving Facebook for other apps like Snapchat.
That's true, yeah. We've seen some third-party researchers have come out, especially this year, that have found that Facebook's teen audience is kind of slowly declining, and are at the very best, it's kind of staying, it's plateauing, it's staying where it is. And you have to look at a Snapchat as a real reason that a lot of kids are kind of going and trying something new. Thankfully for Facebook, they own Instagram, which is probably Snapchat's biggest competitor and kind of Facebook's one app that is really still relevant with that teen audience. So they do have an app that kind of appeals to that age group, but I think that they're trying to certainly look for other options and again, start even younger.
What does Facebook say to critics who believe that 13 or 12 or 11 or 10 is too young for this kind of technology, that it could harm development or social skills?
So, you know, when the company unveiled the app, they did a little press briefing and they brought three executives to kind of talk about Messenger Kids. And all three of them were parents with kids themselves. And the way that they pitched it and framed it was, hey, these kids are using technology regardless, right? They're going to have iPads. They're going to have phones. They don't wait until the age of 13 to first get on the internet. So they're going to find ways to communicate with their friends or, you know, as a parent, you need to communicate with your kids to pick them up from school or practice or whatever may be. So they're going to do this regardless. So let's go ahead and make an app that is safer for them. This is how Facebook is framing it. They're basically saying, if it's going to happen, it should happen through us.
Well, you say safer. I was just reading an article about Snapchat, which has been trying to prevent that app from being used by sex predators, which has turned out to be quite a problem for them. Does this app address that issue, that these 12-year-olds or whatever might be able to communicate with people who are up to no good?
In theory, it should. The way that it's set up is that the parent of the kid who's using the app has to approve of all contacts on the app. So if the kid wants to talk to a friend from school, his or her mom or dad actually needs to connect with the mom or dad of the friend and connect the two kids that way. So it should prevent, you know, a random stranger, a potential threat from coming in and chatting with the children through this app. Of course, there are tons of ways. If you have a smartphone, there are a lot of ways for people to reach you, including just simply calling or texting you with a phone number. So that's why Facebook, again, is saying this is a better option because the parents have more control over who the kids are talking to.
And are there any legal requirements for apps directed at kids, or is it up to the companies themselves to police their services?
So there's all kinds of laws that are meant to protect children, especially under the age of 13, which is one of the reasons that Facebook's age limit is 13, because when you get below that, you know, you have to do things like get parental consent for a lot of stuff. You have to be very, very transparent about what data you're collecting from kids. You can't really target them with advertising the way you can with people who are over the age of 13. So Facebook is definitely, you know, there are a lot of, you can tell based on all the restrictions of this app, again, going back to the parents needing to manually approve of all contacts. Those are the kinds of things that Facebook is doing to try and ensure that this doesn't, run afoul of any laws. The challenge, again, for them will be as they expand this into other countries, all those other countries are going to have their own laws around, you know, reaching children. And so Facebook's going to theoretically have to create, you know, new versions of this for all the different countries they go into. That's going to be a huge challenge, which explains why they're only launching it in the United States for now.
That's Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. Kurt, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.